Sea Realm Vault Podcast, episode number 331. Thursday, March 28th, 2019.
The light of consciousness shines on everyone, but not everyone gains access to the vault.
Hey everybody, KMO here, and what you're about to hear is a conversation that I recorded yesterday on Zoom. I don't use Skype anymore, thanks Microsoft. And it is with a guy that I knew as John McGuire, but who, at least for the public conversation, the public portion of it is on YouTube already. He called himself John Connor, and I don't know if that's a Terminator reference or not. But John started up a podcast, I don't know how long ago it was, it's getting weird for me. Seems like it was just yesterday, but apparently he's been quiet for a couple of years. So it's been at least a couple of years since I talked to him for his show. And he contacted me via email and asked if we could reconnect. And I didn't realize at the time that he wasn't doing a podcast right now. He basically just wanted to talk. But, you know, I do have a podcast to feed, so I'm happy to talk, but it's got to be recorded and it's got to be something I could share with the Sea Realm Vault audience. And I think that's what you have here. So I know that most of you are not podcasters, you're not journalists of any sort, and you don't really bump up against the ethical dilemma of how you conduct yourself in an argument when you have the power of the edit. But I formulated a rule for myself based on, you know, having been on the wrong side of that whole equation, that if I'm in a conversation, a recorded conversation, and it's with somebody that I'm disagreeing with, which is what's going to happen in the conversation you're about to hear, afterwards, I don't give myself the opportunity to score unanswered points against my opponent. To me, that is just bad form. And so I'll just stress here at the beginning that as you listen to my conversation with John, keep in mind, I am the father of two teenage boys who are both lily white. And the idea that they don't get to have a say or that their position in any conversation is to be diminished or discarded because of their white skin, I am a mortal enemy of that point of view. So I don't lean on my kids in the conversation you're about to hear. In fact, I don't mention them at all. But that is the center of where I'm coming from in this conversation and on most conversations on the topics that I'm going to cover in this conversation with John, which you'll hear in just a moment. After the conversation, I wrote to John and I asked him if I should remove his comments about Jason Horsley, which come at the very beginning. And he said, no, I could leave them in there. If you know of or know Jason Horsley, it is within your power to stir the poo by, you know, forwarding these comments on to him. I would suggest that you don't. But of course, you have paid for access to the contents of this conversation, and what you do with the knowledge that you gain is your business. Although again, I would ask that you not stir the poo, particularly not unnecessarily, not just for the sake of stirring the poo. John did also mention in some after the conversation email correspondence that he has a blog that he'd like you to have a look at. He describes it as an attempted spoof on Jordan Peterson's philosophy. And it is called cleanyourroomnow.wordpress.com. I'll have a link to it in the show notes for this episode. All right, here is my conversation with John. Hello.
Hey, how are you?
I'm well.
So you're in Vermont, yes?
I am.
We're on opposite sides of the country. I'm in Oregon. But right now, my partner lives in Vancouver, BC. So I'm here visiting.
Oh, very nice.
I'm on the West Coast, Pacific Northwest generally. But when I last talked to you, I was living in upstate New York. So I was much closer to you at that point.
So I considered going back and re-listening to our previous conversation. But then when I got to your website, I opted for a conversation with Jason Horsley instead. So
did you Did you listen to my conversation with Jason Horsley, or you had a conversation with him?
I listened to yours. Part of it, anyway.
Horsley is, I mean, I don't know what you think of him nowadays, but I have all sorts of issues with him. And as good as that interview was, I feel in ways like I still kind of regret that one. I'm going to talk about being a responsible platformer and what I think someone stands for. I don't love Jason nowadays, but I'd love to hear your thoughts on him, even if you're on the opposite side of that, because I'm struggling to find things to like about him anymore.
Huh. I don't follow his stuff very consistently, but I like his conversations with Jim Kunstler. He gets Jim into some territory that very few people can drag him into. Have you heard those?
That's what Jason does. He's manipulative. If I had to, like, I know him personally a bit. Like, I'm saying that as someone that actually knows him. Now, he's wonderful, but he is like, he's more just iconoclastic for the sake of being iconoclastic. Sometimes I don't know what Jason believes, if he even believes anything. He's very all over the map. Though at times he is consistent. He'll go for stretches, especially with his new incarnation of his podcast. And his sort of, all I can say is it's like an anti-trans, anti-gay, anti-a lot of things platform nowadays. And it's not so much about actual self-analysis and actual like psychology the way it used to be. So I feel like he's moved away from that. Anyway, I'm glad you listened to our talk, but if you're going to bring him up, I had to mention that.
Okay. What's the new podcast called? I'm not even familiar with it.
Jason's?
Yeah.
I mean, it's, I think it's Audi Culture, A-U-T-I Culture. I think that's still what it's called. It used to be called Stormy Weather. Stormy Weather is long gone, but that was like, you know, he was doing that and then he disappeared for a time. But I mean, I can relate for doing things and disappearing. That's what I'm doing now. I've been gone for 2.5 years or something. So I haven't been making content or even having any conversations. So this is new for me again. And so I appreciate you making time and working with me on this. It's a fun project just to get back into discussions.
Well, for folks who possibly didn't hear our previous conversation, what's in broad strokes, what's your large project?
I mean, I don't have a project anymore. I used to do interviews with people that I thought were interesting, and that largely focused on what I just brought up with Jason, self-analysis, psychonautics, what is the water we're swimming in sort of approach to topics. So big question, no answers sort of things. Like, I don't think I answered much throughout that journey, but I do find it valuable, but I have sort of left that project behind. So I'm presently not working on much, but I do try to pay attention to what's going on and try to read reality still in more of a grounded way. Like, you know, what is the push and pull and the forces in our life and the push and pull in other people's lives? And how do we build community in a future that's sustainable out of that? So I find that a lot more interesting nowadays than, is the mind disconnected from the body or not? You know, can we have out-of-body experiences that are legitimate? I mean, I've sort of left those questions behind, even if I do think they're interesting. I'm sort of more fascinated with, what is the human race doing and can we survive?
Can we survive? Well, let's start there. What do you think? I was just before we got on the line here, I was reading a Vice article about this paper by a environmental academic who basically went full doomer. And his paper's kind of gone viral. So the paper is called Deep Adaptation, A Map for Navigating Climate Tragedy. The author, what is the author's name? How strange. You'd think in writing an article about an academic paper, you'd mention the
it would be cited.
Author.
Yeah, properly cited.
Anyway, I think he's Scottish.
Okay.
But basically, you know, I think the article starts off by saying most academic papers have three readers.
Yeah.
This one has had hundreds of thousands.
Okay.
And, you know, it's gone viral because it's full doom. And there's an appetite for that.
I mean, to be fair, though, there's still just an appetite for climate change. And, like, I don't know. Sometimes, I mean, we could say that this is just due to people's doomer complex, that this got the most attention. But I don't know. There's a lot of randomness in how things get attention in the climate change world. So I just know that climate change is important to people. And yeah, I fair enough, but
in terms of academic papers, I mean, they get published by the ton.
Yeah, of course.
Most of them have almost no readers. This one has caught the popular imagination, and I'm pretty sure it's mainly because the author is he's making no pretense at objectivity or sort of dispassionate presentation of the facts. He's gone full doomer. He says civilization's going to collapse in 10 years.
Well, I mean, we are talking about models, right? And so we're filtering a reality through our models, and that's definitely still useful in political discussions, I found. So carrying over from past work I've done. And all I can say is that, like, we're all seeing things through different models. And, you know, even if I'm not a full doomer, I am still, I guess I border on alarmist, just because climate change is making things hugely impossible. I mean, even more impossible for what are called frontline communities, especially people like indigenous communities here in British Columbia or elsewhere, whose relationship with the land and the water and other environmental issues, I mean, beyond climate change, but also closely tethered to that, but I think are very important. And so we can't lose sight of like the disastrous outcomes of climate change on the human outcome and the human toll. I don't think collapse works the way that most people think. Like, I'm kind of with you on how I view collapse. And so I don't think everything's going to end tomorrow, or that how peak oil has been projected is exactly how it works. But I do think these things are still worth talking about and valuable. But I do appreciate that you don't love the alarmism. But I do also know that some people think we're running out of time, you know, and like, I do think that extinction, we have the ability to make ourselves extinct. So we have to be careful.
Yep. I won't claim credit for this. Somebody in the Sea Realm group on MeWe, he said that he's come to realize that to a large extent, his fascination with the peak oil collapse was largely his personal way of coming to terms with the inevitability of his own personal extinction, which, you know, we all have to come to terms with in one way or another. Unless, of course, we die suddenly in our youth, in which case we don't have to struggle with it. We just die. Mm-hmm. But for the most part, we live long enough with the realization that we ourselves will die. And it's really, really difficult, I think, for a lot of people, myself included, to really sink the teeth of their imagination into the idea that there's going to be a whole lot that happens in human history after we ourselves have left the scene. And there's a certain comfort in believing that that's not the case, that when we die, we're going to go out in a blaze of glory that takes down the whole civilization with us and the whole species.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's, we don't know. The future is completely unpredictable in that sense. We don't know, but we have to be cognizant of threats and trends, and we can't help but predict. I mean, this is maybe the heart of consciousness is the human predilection to predict, and it creates all sorts of quandaries. Like you said, fear of death. I mean, just our whole conception of time leads to our fear of death. And here we are creating culture and other things to keep ourselves away from that fear, you know, distracting ourselves to death to avoid the real death. So these are the cycles we run in. But at the same time, like, yeah, I think a lot of these conversations, sometimes they are their own islands and they don't intersect well with everything else, or they don't intersect often enough for people to know that all these things do add up to a larger problem. And it's okay to focus on, I think, small pieces of the puzzle, even if people would accuse you of being compartmentalized or something. It all adds up to something relevant in my mind. We're all doing what we can, if that makes sense.
Let me ask you, what subjects did you want to explore when you contacted me about this conversation?
That's a really good question, because I don't know. I sort of checked in a little bit where you were at on your YouTube, and I tried some months back to go back to Facebook, but found that you had left, and I didn't know the complete story about that. And
I was crushed. I didn't jump.
Yeah, I'm glad you released a video explaining some of exactly why you're gone, because I knew it was over your pronouns, but otherwise I didn't know what.
It wasn't about pronouns, it was about proper nouns.
Okay, fair enough. I appreciate that. But with that said, I didn't know why you had left, and but I knew that that topic was important to you, so I wasn't surprised that it was over something like that. And although it was interesting to find out that it was initiated in a Star Trek forum, because I also find the new Star Trek deplorable in the same ways you do. It's just like a big fucking hot mess of explosions. And Orville is just such a better representation of what Star Trek is supposed to be, even if it's a little to Seth MacFarlane at times. I feel that has dialed that back a bit, both to its benefit and detriment. So I don't know. I feel like that's just a more interesting show. So anyway, another sidetrack completely. So maybe we talk about Orville. You know, the political climate generally, I grew up in a conservative household. So I guess I've always had a sort of a morbid fascination with the conservative mind and like the evolution of, say, Burkean conservatism or paleoconservatism or whatever you would label it or title it, and to see how that's playing out in the modern landscape and to see how that overlaps with New Left and other movements, and just sort of see how things are, like, you know, again, the push and pull. We could talk about specific news items, but I'm also interested in sort of general dynamics that way.
Well, I think the big general news item of the last week or so is the Mueller investigation. We didn't actually get the report, but we got a summary of the report by somebody who is, you know, far from neutral, but still, it takes quite a stretch of the imagination to say that really Mueller found evidence of collusion between Trump and Putin, you know, during the campaign, and it's just being suppressed by the Trump administration. I mean, I know people are taking that exact line, but
yeah, I mean, like, I think
it delving deeper into fantasy.
Yeah, I mean, I think it answers a couple questions. It doesn't answer some others, and it does leave us some others unanswered. I mean, like, I think there's a lot of possible criminal indictments against Trump that don't have anything to do with Russia, quite frankly. And if the Mueller investigation was focused mostly on that, I'm not surprised that it didn't really touch the rest. And as far as obstruction of justice, it laid out sort of pros and cons for each. And the report basically said, you know, we don't, there's evidence for and against it, but we're not the people to pursue it. So, I mean, that's for another, it's legal opinion. You know, this is how the law works sometimes. It can operate in a gray area. So I still think that, like, Trump is a highly corrupt person. I think he has highly unethical dealings on the side. I think those are all, you know, he's a pay for play type of person. This is who he's always been. We shouldn't be shocked by that when he brings it to the White House. And yeah, I mean, as far as like collusion with Putin, no, I didn't necessarily think they were in the back room plotting world domination, nor did I think that they actually like coordinated specific things. I do think Russia was interested in having Trump win. Of course, he's the most right candidate. Why wouldn't Putin want him to win? So, right. You know what I'm saying? Like, that was obvious to me. So that alliance just makes sense on a practical level. So whatever propaganda they did wasn't at Trump's behest, obviously. But I do think that, you know, all large countries interfere with each other in some way in terms of like wanting to push elections in certain ways. Not all of them, but you know what I'm saying.
Yeah, the big players.
Yeah.
Rwanda's not doing a whole lot to influence our elections.
Not now, maybe someday.
Yeah, maybe. What's really interesting to me is that, as you mentioned, there are so many different fronts on which to criticize Donald Trump where you don't have to invent some fantasy, and yet it's the fantasy that found traction, and found traction in a big way, such that, you know, the mainstream corporate media outlets ran with it with a sort of fervor and just enthusiasm that is really, it's kind of hard to wrap one's mind around, you know, unless you share the fantasy. But he is, well, I think, so corrupt in so many different ways. You know, why reach for this fairy tale when there's just this wealth of opportunities in front of you to criticize the man? It's very strange.
Well, the mainstream media, I mean, like, I don't think there is a mainstream left media, but the centrist media for sure, like CNN, et cetera, I do feel like there's sort of like a gentleman's or gentlewoman's or gentle person's agreement about, you know, how the elite treat each other with kids gloves more often than not. And as much as they'll talk about some like tabloid shit or other stuff, you know, they don't dig into money laundering. They don't dig into the money laundering side of what Trump does, because of course that sort of influences all of them, because it's an economic, you know, interest question in a lot of ways. And I don't think it's I don't think it's a conspiracy. That's ridiculous. But there's unconscious forces at play here, and we do live in the system we live in, and people's allegiances are sort of pushed and pulled this way unconsciously. And so even if they're his critics, and yes, they have focused on some correct criticisms of him, yeah, some have been a little far off base. But I mean, again, my information on this has never come from CNN or whoever, you know.
So where in Oregon did you say you're living?
I'm in Portland.
Okay. That's very easy for me to picture.
Yeah. I'm very white. It's a white place. I fit in there.
Oh, it is very white. And if you head anywhere east of Portland, it basically feels like Idaho, really.
Yeah, I remember going to Idaho, driving to Idaho from Portland, and I just couldn't believe what like a barren wasteland it was. It was unbelievable. It was like the fucking desert, you know? It was weird.
Yep, same is true in Washington State. Once you get just a little bit east of Seattle, you're in what they call the high desert.
Yeah.
Not much happening, you know, ecologically or culturally or anything.
I mean, as someone that's not seen it much, I did find it interesting and fun to like drive through and adventure through for a bit, but it's a cultural desert as well. So I would go insane living there.
Alrighty. So we've got the excesses of the mainstream media, and there in Portland, you certainly see playing out in the streets, I would guess, all manner of cultural excess. It seems to be a magnet both for, you know, the extremists on the left and the right who want to go and battle each other in the streets.
I think to some extent that's true, but I do think that, politics is unavoidably confrontational, and so I expect people to be out there and kind of sometimes getting into situations that are messy, okay? So this is like democracy at work, and I'm okay with that in theory. I don't draw any false equivalencies between left and right necessarily. I do see problems on the left, but I do think that making it a like an equal side, sort of like good people on both sides, sort of, we have to be careful. That's all I'm saying. It's like we need to criticize our own, but we need to understand what solidarity is. And sometimes when our own biases and misunderstandings of people that are actually on our side begin to interfere with that solidarity. So that's all I'm interested in picking apart on the left. And I'm not really, I think the right is toxic in almost all its incarnations. And whether you want to say there's toxic elements on the left or not, it's not in any way in the same proportion. And it's not in any way on the same philosophical level. If that makes any sense.
It makes sense. It just, who counts as the right? Because if you read, you know, a lot of leftists or listen to them, anybody who is at all to the right of them, meaning, you know, centrists, are far right, you know? Mm-hmm. It's okay to punch Nazis and everybody you disagree with is a Nazi. I mean, the people that I've heard called Nazis, you know, the accuser says it with a straight face and expects to be taken seriously is absurd. You know, people call Sam Harris a Nazi. He's clearly not a Nazi. He's a liberal, you know, centrist with basically he's more analytical in his style, which, you know, to the left, it seems just equals Nazi until proven otherwise, you know, the far kind of crazy left.
So I am occasionally one of those people, and I don't know if you're talking about interactions you've had in real life or interactions online or a mix of those things. I mean, most of my political interactions is just sort of a shut-in or online, unfortunately. So yeah, I do see a lot of extreme like language and statements on both sides. And I know like in your Facebook video, you said you weren't always the person you think you are online and the person you want to be, and ditto for that on my end. I'll like misbehave a bit because it is a spot we can misbehave. If we're talking about morals and ethics and how it applies to a digital space where there's no, like we're looking at each other face to face. It's that helps for me for accountability. But when we're not looking at each other, sometimes that can be easy to drift into our own sort of sadistic behavior, which is what we all have. I mean, just psychologically speaking, we're all a little sadists, we're all a little masochistic, we're all dealing with that in our own ways. And, you know, before you left Facebook, I can recall you've had so many conversations, I don't expect you to remember this, but I called Sam Harris a warmonger, mm-hmm. and that ignited quite a conversation between us that was unexpected for me, knowing you from the podcast and being such a balanced and chill, and even if we disagree, like we find ways not to like get too nasty, and I felt like it got kind of nasty. So I do know what you're talking about in terms of like, and I've been there too. I've been misbehaved, but I do think online it can get messy, and so I don't really hold people completely accountable for that. But I do say, like, if you look at like, okay, so left online culture, it's SJW-esque, which again, we can talk about that term term and how I really despise it because I think it's a right-created term. It's almost slightly derogatory, but anyway, that's beside the point. If you look at left culture, which is, yes, a bit judgy and a bit like, you know, white knighting, okay, this is the whole foundation of criticisms of leftists online nowadays. But if you look at the right, I mean, look at the disgusting memes, the disgusting conversations. Like you go to any many right-wing Reddit subforums and it's just anti-woman, fucking anti-government, anti-taxes. It's just like all this stereotypical nonsense that like you see Fox News pump out a lot. And so that's what I'm talking about by the right. And I do think for worse, that does make up most of the right. I don't fault anyone for being a conservative. Like we can have a sane conversation about conservatism versus liberalism and leftism and whatever, all the full spectrum of political representation. But I do think that the right wing, generally speaking, has always been the right end of power. And it's always in, at least psychologically reinforced a power element in how we run our governments and how we interact with each other, really run our families, everything, you know, it goes down to the micro level. So this is what I'm talking about, conservatism and what bothers me about it. And again, like someone that grew up in a very conservative household, yeah, in some sense, I have just an irrational dislike of it, but also I have that lived experience and I've reflected a lot on it and sort of how it affects people and how it affects our world. But as a progressive, I'm certainly not ignorant of problems on the left and problems you see with, say, judgment of, you know, differing opinions or calling each other Nazis and these sorts of things. I do also see like we do build walls. As a white person, I can admit to being on the racist spectrum. And I think we all have to admit that and how we work with that and how we work with our sexism and other things that are still kind of, especially as white men, like these are things we're dealing with. And people on the left, it's a big tent. And there's like a lot of people, a lot of different life experiences that we have to be more sensitive to than people do on the right, where it seems like right on the right, everyone's a one issue voter and they can just ignore all the shitty stuff they do. But on the left, we try to hold each other accountable. And when that happens, it gets really messy sometimes and it looks like it's chaos, but I don't really see it that way.
What are some of these subreddits that you haunt that are
I don't haunt them, but I will say that like if you talk about, you brought up Jason Horsley, like his big one of his big focuses was Pizzagate. Uh-huh. Pizzagate.
He took it seriously?
Oh yes. Huh. Dead, like very, very, very seriously. Okay. The point where he made a you're either with me or against me on this sort of thing, and it's like it's absurd. And so Pizzagate was started in a conservative subreddit, the QAnon conspiracy shit. I mean, this is all Reddit based or 4chan based, you know? So these, and I'm not saying that like stupid stuff doesn't come out of the left, but like, it's not like this. It's not driving news cycles like this is and influencing the entire conversation we're having about politics and what's happening in the world, you know?
I haven't read it, but I read summations of it and listened to presentations by the authors. But there was a book recently about propaganda and about, you know, the new extremism, basically, that is, you know, that marks our political discussions and our culture. And the authors basically blame Fox News. They say that Fox News is mining stuff from the far right fringes and mainstreaming it for their audience. That, you know, they track the use of certain words and phrases and they originate in places like 4chan or, you know, over on Breitbart or something, but they're pretty insignificant until Fox News picks them up and runs with them. And then suddenly the prevalence of those phrases, you know, the frequency with which they're used online just shoots through the roof. And the authors of this book, apparently, I haven't read the whole book. I'm basically just reporting summaries. Is that Fox News is the primary player in, you know, in driving extremism in our cultural conversation.
I don't think that's completely wrong. I mean, obviously I feel like Fox News is a fascinating case study because I do think in many ways it's helped drive the news cycle and drive the framing for how we, again, read our stories and are fed the news. And I mean, this even goes back to, say, like the Bush election, where Fox News announced that he had won the state without having won it, right? And ever since then, it's almost been like Fox News has been wagging the dog in a lot of ways. And so I totally understand that point of view as a mega force in the news industry, because we live in a capitalist society. The news companies are competing and they want viewers. And Fox News got lots and lots of viewers. And that can't be denied. And so that's actually a relevant story, and how these big players in these industries actually create the culture that the rest of this, the other businesses will follow. So I think in that sense, yeah, Fox News does sort of have shaped our news in a lot of ways. It's not the only thing. It's just like capitalism, period, and also other dynamics in terms of unconscious forces. But yeah, I wouldn't say it's the only thing, but it's certainly a big force. And if we're talking about the big news networks, it might be the most influential over the last, whatever, 20 years or whenever it came out, mid-90s or something.
Yeah, I don't remember when Fox entered the scene.
It's been a while, but I mean, it has been more than like a quarter of a century. So I do think it's sort of like a new era in news in terms of like what they brought to sort of like, you know, tabloid mixed with, but that also goes with, like I said, cutbacks in investigative journalism, the journalism industry, and so on. So all these forces converge to make our news very shitty overall, and how we get information rather shitty. But I think Fox News is the shittiest for sure, and I don't mind someone pointing that out.
I think all TV news suffers from the fact that in the 20th century, almost all news stories started with a newspaper story, with investigative journalism done by newspaper reporters. And then radio and TV would basically pick that up and run with it. But most of the investigation was done on behalf of a newspaper. And when the newspaper funding model disintegrated, you know, with the birth of the internet, a lot of investigative reporting just stopped happening.
Right.
And at the same time, the cable news channels with their 24-hour streams, you know, they needed a lot more content. So we have vastly more content being produced based on a tiny fraction of the research that used to be done, you know, the investigation that used to form the basis of news stories. So it's, you know, exploded in volume and just withered in terms of the actual research content upon which these stories are based. It's a bad combination, really.
Yeah, it is. And that's why this is why mainstream news is bad. It's not because it's like there's a huge conspiracy amongst all of them to create false stories or this and that. I mean, they have a culture and they have a way of doing things, and they think that they're right, even though they're horribly wrong in a lot of ways. And it's just like, you know, I really appreciate the internet in terms of there's like a lot of interesting solid news sources, and no, you can't just rely on one, but I mean, you can consolidate around a lot of them and try to triangulate on what seems to be a rational and grounded point of view and compassionate point of view. But yeah, you have to look internationally. You can't just also just live in the American news cycle, because you're going to get lost, because it's like too many things are connected and we live in too complex a world to just be paying attention to here. Though I understand that domestic issues are huge, and like I'm more focused on them, but seeing how everything kind of is connected on the global scale helps too.
How do you spend your days?
You know, nowadays I'm working a bit less, though that won't be lasting for long. But for right now, I have a little extra time. So I am catching up in terms of reading things I wanted to read, fill holes in my knowledge. I think as I get older, like if I feel static, completely static in my thinking, or think that I've figured everything out, I begin to feel a bit nauseous and anxious. And that, yeah. And I think that anyone that likes to pursue knowledge, whatever you do that, you know, I think can understand that feeling a bit. And so my free time, yeah, it's spent trying to learn about what's going on. I could be doing a better time of like, you know, growing my skill set and doing other things like that, but that's on my shelf as well. But learning, I'm trying to get out in my community a bit more and just like attend events, see people, see how people are organizing and getting things done at a local, municipal, state level, you know, like what's in my backyard versus what's necessarily happening federally or internationally, because I have so little impact on that. And we have so little impact even where we are, but I mean, if we focus our energy, we can get stuff done where we're at, I think. So I'm trying to like figure out how I fit into my own community. You know, as someone that thinks a lot about community, it's how do I start to participate and do better that way?
What are some events you've attended recently?
I just attended a talk about Indigenous womanhood and Indigenous struggle in what has been a racist society in the West. And this is for, and this is in British Columbia. So the First Nations people, that is a very large community here and helps develop a lot of the political discussion around disenfranchised communities and what have you. So they were holding a small question and answer on female performers. Specifically, they are Indigenous First Nation burlesque performers and also they're performative dancers. The other group, there were two separate people speaking, a burlesque performer and just interpretive dance. And through that learning, the importance of body and movement and moving through grief and remembering the women that have been disappeared and the men that have been disappeared, the Indigenous people that have been disappeared, that if we face it, if we look at like how structural racism works, they're always lowest on the totem pole in terms of, we'll get, when the police get around to it, they'll get around to it. Otherwise, other people get priority. And this is like a story that, you know, isn't in the news cycle that much, but they're telling it through their art and they're telling it through their personal stories. And they come to these events to try to share that, hopefully with white idiots like me, but also with whoever wants to listen. But white people need to listen the most. So I'm sort of on that social justice track right now and trying to correct any misinterpretations I've had, because it's been easy to live in my own political bubble for quite a while and not really stretch out into feminist circles or communities of color or other issues that, as a white male, it's always been like, well, it doesn't, who cares? It's not my problem. Like, these are fringe issues, you know? I got to worry about minimum wage. It's like, there's a lot more out there and there's a lot more to learn for us. So I'm trying to do that.
I have to say, I'm a little bothered by phrases like white idiots like me.
I'm not, as you can tell, but yeah. It's well, fair enough that you are troubled by that, and I'm open to talking about that.
Well, what does it do for you? I mean, why would you gravitate to an attitude like that?
I think it's an accountability thing. Mm-hmm. I think it's a historical accountability thing. I think that white people have very rarely seen themselves as a culture, and it's interesting to talk about it as a culture in a historical sense. And how really over the history of mercantilism till now, I see that as sort of like a very largely connected picture. And it's been a lot of white on people of color violence and cultural genocides and whatever we think of Western culture and its pros, there's a lot of cons. And there hasn't been, I feel like, a lot of accountability by, say, I'm Irish and Italian. And as far as like players in the slave trade, you know, I could get into that, but it's like my, generally speaking, say the Irish, you know, no, they didn't always sail the boats and do these things and bring the slaves over, but they were good overseers and they were good participants in the slave trade and they benefited from their skin color in that, even if, say, Joe Bajan, like he always talked about how his Scots-Irish people were always shit on badly, and they are. And on the white person totem pole, they're towards the bottom, but they're also oppressors. And so like we all have work to do in terms of coming to terms with history, and it's truth and reconciliation for me. Like, it's just, for me, it's about truth and reconciliation. It's not about moralizing. It's not about being self-righteous or thinking I'm better than anyone or thinking that I have to play race cards or anything. But like, race is a thing. It's a culture. It's not inborn. It's not in our genes. I get it. Like, we're all human and we're all that, but it's also ridiculous to say that there haven't been huge historical consequences and contemporary outcomes and continuing contemporary outcomes for people of color and other frontline communities that are dealing with really largely the mistakes of white culture. And so I'm trying to come to terms with that. And I get it. We're not all totally responsible, but when we're talking about the messy parts of history and truth and reconciliation, I think we can all be points of healing if we want to be, and we don't have to be defensive about it. Like, I'm not making a moral statement about you or me if I say that I'm racist or you're racist. Like, I just think it's a spectrum and there's no getting around it. The same as I said earlier, we're all a little sadistic and we're all a little masochistic. We're all a little racist too. And that's everyone, including all people, but it's especially pernicious in white people, I think, because we have the power dynamic on our side. Does that make sense?
Oh, I've heard these arguments many times before.
I know you have. And it's I do think they're sane, and I can see where you're coming from. But at the same time, it's like, there's a lot of fucking pain out there, man. And we have to like start working around that if we want political solutions too. It's not ignoring it. I don't think ignoring it's going to solve anything.
Are you familiar with John Ronson's book, So You've Been Publicly Shamed?
No, but I mean, I know I've investigated call-out culture, so whatever you have to say about it, we can talk about that.
Well, this is particular to John Ronson's point. It's that he was really looking at Twitter, you know, Twitter shamings and people getting mobbed on Twitter. Like Justine Sacco is the, you know, the most famous case. She only had like a couple hundred followers, and she makes a racially insensitive tweet, which was clearly, you know, a failed attempt at a joke. A joke based on her own white privilege. And, you know, she gets on a plane, flies to South Africa, and by the time she gets there, tens of thousands of people want her blood. You know, she's got to slink out of the airport with sunglasses on, trying to avoid contact with all of these people who were furious with her. And John Ronson's point is that, you know, power, particularly online, is not a fixed thing. It shifts very quickly. And so, yeah, Justine, she's coming from a place of privilege when she makes her bad joke, but when 10,000 people wish you ill, you know, your power there, particularly on Twitter, is gone. She is a leaf being blown in a, you know, a rather tumultuous wind at that point. And when I hear, say, you know, women in Silicon Valley complaining about sexism and how white men have all the power, you know, if you're making, say, 10 times as much money as I am, you have the opportunity to travel, you don't have to worry about healthcare, I'm not particularly receptive to your complaints about, you know, how white men have all the power. Clearly, you're speaking from a position of extreme privilege, you know, in singling out white men as being this evil. When I'm, you know, here in Vermont, southern Vermont, southern rural Vermont, I'm surrounded by white people with no education, shitty jobs, no prospects for really doing anything in their life that they're not already doing. You know, it's there's so much more going on. And when the people making the complaints seem to have it so much better than so many of the people they're complaining about, my compassion, well, you know, it runs a bit dry.
Fair enough. I will say in response that I think when we see someone that's more powerful than us, makes more money than us, is more privileged than us, but say they have a different skin color. So the question is, okay, what is the real power dynamic there? But the question is, there's so many people of color that can't speak. And you're saying, well, I mean, I think that there is some sort of responsibility, or it's even okay to say we can use this person as a symbol for other people who aren't there, aren't as privileged. And these messages do need to get out there. And maybe this person makes $100,000 a year, is just has the time and the energy and the ability and the eloquence to do it. And but speaking for lots of people. And this is like, you know, we're herd animals, and this is how we kind of go sometimes. We need people to speak for us. And we need to figure out in our lives if we're someone that speaks for other people or speaks for ourselves or some blending of the two or neither. You know, we're all different. But when I see someone that's a female or a trans person or a person of color succeeding in society and still saying there's all these oppressions, we should listen. They're succeeding, and they're having a better time than their other brothers and sisters and our brothers and sisters. But it doesn't mean that what they're saying isn't true. Like, and at the same time, what you're saying is true. There's lots of white people in Vermont that are poor. I see lots of poor fucking homeless people and other people struggling in Portland. Capitalism is a brutal system in terms of how it separates resources and separates people from their power, you know, and their personal power, not just their financial power. So it's a problem for sure for all skin colors, but these are that like there's just invisible dynamics in society. So if we're talking about walls and what's keeping us from building the communities we want, like, and need and like to come together, we need to be able to kind of like, it's like on the left, I feel like there's just a lot of different languages that we need to learn to speak. And it's not about forcing everyone to say, you speak my language. It's all about whoever does have the privilege and the power, whatever our skin color or whatever. It's like, I do think it's okay to kind of look. I don't see a person of color that's privileged saying that. And I can't say that they're a hypocrite because it's like they've had to struggle harder than me as a white person, period. The statistics say it. Like, just statistically, we're just talking about raw data. I'm a data-driven person. This isn't just some emotional argument for me. I mean, like, I've had to be data-driven in my life to survive and be where I'm at. So I'm not just saying this as someone that feels like I've been shamed into thinking this way. Because I'm an obstinate person. I don't like being told what to do. I don't like being told what to think. I've always appreciated your independent-mindedness and your resistance to being manipulated and other things. Like, I get it. Like, I get that sensation as well. And I do resist it, but I do realize that it's like, we're what, 90 to 95% unconscious. And unless you look at your own personal history and where we come from and how we've gotten here, you're going to take a lot of yourself for granted and you're going to look like an idiot. And that's why I say I'm a white idiot, because for a long time I took my history and how I grew up and other things for granted, if that's communicated clearly.
Well, it's one thing to call yourself a white idiot. It's something very different to call somebody else a white idiot. And I understand the justifications that folks on the left give for saying that it's okay to use white as an insult in a way that you couldn't use any other skin tone.
I don't think insult's the right word, but go on.
I was just...
It might have negative connotations. I don't mind it having negative connotations, but I don't know if that's necessarily an insult. I think we're, again, kind of being a little fragile about it here, but go on.
Well, you can go on Twitter and you can make some categorical statement about fucking white men and how horrible they are. And you're not going to get kicked off of Twitter. You're not going to be censured in any way. But if you change one word, if you change it from white to black, you will be banned. I mean, you will lose your account. You will lose your privileges. You know, you will not be able to participate in the public conversation that takes place in that forum. There's a very stark asymmetry in opinions which can be expressed in a public forum. And, you know, certain words are good. You can say, you can claim all manner of categorical characteristics about white people that if you just change the one word, you know, the one color word in the sentence, suddenly you go from being somebody with all of Silicon Valley at your back to somebody who's really trying to, you know, sail upstream, paddle upstream.
Well, again, and like, I don't necessarily always look to Silicon Valley for like stories in terms of how to judge our politically correct culture or progress or regress in identity politics. I think it's, again, a bit murky because there is so much money in that world that it's like a lot of it, you can just come off saying, oh, this is all ridiculous white, rich people arguing with each other. But it's like, again, they are speaking to larger problems going on, number one. And number two, as far as what you perceive to be a double standard, again, I just can't see it as a complete double standard because there have been really bad say, we've switched black and white, okay? Mm-hmm. Even over the last, just to take the last 40, 50 years of popular culture, the representations of white people to black people, I mean, black people have always been the demon and white people have always been the savior through our media, through our movies, through our books, through the news cycle about the super predators who are always black. You know what I mean? Like, this is, there have been a creation, a cultural oppression here. Okay. And this is a historical trend that we are both a part of and not a part of, but we have to take ownership of, I feel. And so, yes, I can see that in a vacuum, that is a double standard, but we don't live in a historical vacuum. And we are still contending with these very thorny historical, psychological, emotional, political, personal and collective issues. And I feel like these all factor into that. So we can say, well, this is trivial or a double standard, and you just switch that around. But the truth is, like, whiteness does have different connotations than blackness, just in the historical record and what we're living with now. And I don't mind talking about them differently. I want there to be clarity in defining that difference. And again, I'm not, what online culture is or isn't, again, I can't speak for that. I can only speak for myself and for scholars of race and critical race theory and other academic subjects that study this. These are trends that we have to be dealing with and not look at them in a moral way and not look at them in a you're offending me or hurting my feelings way. Like, I felt like you had a real moment of clarity in your video about the Christchurch shooting, and you said you went and watched that video because people were telling people not to go see it, not to look at it. And after you saw it, you said, you know, I wish I didn't do that. And going and doing that because someone, I felt like I was egging me on, like, that was kind of dumb. And it's like, I think these are, that was a beautiful moment of self-reflection and why I come back to your work and I come back to you. And even here we are disagreeing over something, I find it hard that we're disagreeing on, but I understand it and I appreciate what you're saying. But I also understand, it's just like, I feel like sometimes we're giving into some of our more petty impulses when we push back against this stuff. And if we just kept history in mind, it wouldn't, and even contemporary culture, we'd take it a lot less personally. Because yes, I'm not a powerful white person. I'm so poor. I'm so, I'm just, the ways I'm powerless, I can't get into. But I feel that. I feel that. And I understand the sense of there's a double standard being applied to me and how this isn't fair to me and so on. But, you know, the fact is, like, as a white person, I could turn my intergenerational around wealth around in 2 to 3 generations. And for a black person, it would take like 10 to 20 or something absurd. You know, these are just like things I know that statistically the odds are stacked in my favor. And that makes me a lot less defensive, even if like capitalism itself distorts the picture and we're all losers in that system. And we're all losers in this. We're heir apparents of a colonial system. And here we are living with the traumas and the outcomes. And that's both economic and personal and political. And it's really, really darn complicated.
Well, it sounded as if you wanted to say, look, Silicon Valley is not the left. And
center left.
Can't judge the left based on the, you know, the hypocritical behavior of people in Silicon Valley. But because the Silicon Valley and you know, increasingly China, they build the tools that we are using right now to communicate, and they are the gatekeepers. And they say, you know, what speech is allowed, what speech is not allowed. And, you know, they're not answerable to the Constitution. They are not bound by the rules of fair play that, say, a public broadcaster is bound by. And I see the more that Silicon Valley gets really focused, hyper-focused on race and gender and sexuality to the exclusion of all else, they're providing a, you know, an all fronts smokescreen and distraction for neoliberal capitalism. I've heard and read online time and again that if you're interested in talking about class, that you're a racist, because, you know, that means you're excluding talk of racial injustice. But economics affects everybody.
I mean, the core, I feel like when it comes to, say, the Silicon Valley and controlling the information stream, yeah, that's a serious concern. And I hear free speech advocates discussing that in relation to this sort of topic. And I think that it is more of a question of the corporate power element and not so much that, yeah, there's some in Silicon Valley who are more liberal than others. So what? I mean, it's just like, when it comes down to it, these are businesses and they respond to their consumer base. And also in a lot of ways, even if we don't like the problem with consumerism is not necessarily supply and demand, but it's like the way we've structured our supply and demand is grotesque. We're just in an unsustainable way. I'm not saying it's peak oil, but like just the environmental degradation is quite bad. So I guess to cut a long story short, I do think we need to address corporate power, and that is an unmistakable element of everything else in terms of like our economic progression, how corporate boards are structured, how these are allowed to exist as institutions, what are their charters, you know, et cetera. Are they people? These are all things that are still factors. And we could say, well, that's the only thing, and that all this other stuff is a smokescreen and a distraction. But truthfully, I think they do go hand in hand. Okay, it's not a one or the other. And I would certainly never say someone that brings up economics just as a topic of discussion is being racist. And I don't think that you interjecting and saying, well, what about economic forces is not being racist. I think it's a fair question. But if you're doing it because you think you're completely right and you're trying to like convince that person, you know what I mean? Like there's a lot of argumentation of it. It's not like I'm just coming in with to try to build a conversation here. There is a lot of just trolling online. And so when we talk about like this person's being censored for that, this for that, yeah, but I do like some form of rules on a forum and some form of decorum, and racist stuff has no place on there, etc. And that's just the fact of the matter. I can't change that corporations are as powerful as they are right now. That sucks. But I still think that we need codes of decorum and, you know, larger codes of contact when we deal with people we don't really know in society. It's not like we're dealing with our family or friends or even people directly in our community. It's just a different interaction. So we have to have a different way of communicating, I think. So I'm not completely sure if I answered that question or if it was a question, but.
Well, you're not, you know, reading the same books that I'm reading right now or listening to, as the case may be. I've just listened to 3 books in a row, basically, on the topic of Silicon Valley, its origins, its role in creating a systemic surveillance apparatus, the likes of which has never existed before. And, you know, the likes compared to, say, East Germany was quaint compared to Silicon Valley. And, you know, Google, Amazon, Facebook, Microsoft, Apple, these are not just big companies. They're not the problems that arise from the role that these companies play in our lives is completely different from the role of a company, say, like Raytheon or General Dynamics or Ben and Jerry's. I mean, their business is learning about us, creating data sets based on our movements, on our behavior, on our social connections, and monitoring us so closely that, you know, I got kicked off of Facebook because I didn't attach my legal name to my my profile. Therefore, I couldn't be served up basically as, you know, as an entree to advertisers in a way that somebody who gave their app their proper name could. Last week, I had 2 videos taken down off of YouTube, and these videos didn't violate anybody's copyright. I didn't call for violence. I didn't make any categorical statement about protected classes of people, but something in what I said was offensive to somebody. And they reported it to Facebook, and Facebook's modus operandi, not Facebook, YouTube's modus operandi is guilty until proven innocent. Somebody makes a complaint, you are automatically guilty. The punishment is applied automatically before any human views the situation. And then you're allowed to request a review, and you'll get a letter back from YouTube saying, you know, yes, we reviewed your case and the judgment stands, or we reviewed your case and we've overturned it, but there's no explanation given. When you're charged with violating the rules and the punishment is assigned immediately, they don't tell you which rule you broke. They just say, you have violated our standards. Here's a link to our standards. Go and read it. And in fact, that letter that I got from YouTube the first time around said, we encourage you to go and read it through our community standards and then go back and review every single one of your previous videos to see if we missed any infractions and censor yourself on our behalf. You know, the Department of Justice cannot behave that way. Your local right. prosecutor can't behave that way. They are bound by legal structures meant to protect you as an individual. And Silicon Valley, none of those companies have to obey those rules, and none of them do. You know, they're openly not just manipulative, but tyrannical in the way they treat the people who have become dependent on the products that they provide.
May I interject?
Sure, yeah.
So I absolutely agree with this. I don't think, however, that it's going to bring about a tyranny of identity politics censorship. You know, I think that it cuts the other way as well. Like if you are extremely pro-Palestine, for example, and post a lot of Palestinian stuff or make comments about the Palestinian situation, that can get you banned quite easily. People working for Black Lives Matter, you're a black liberation terrorist. I mean, like all these people on watch lists, like these are still people's media outlets and Facebook and social media that get shut down on the regular, not just for having like, not just for stuff like having the wrong name or actually saying something racist. There is stuff on the left too that, you know, the liberal Silicon Valley also fucking shuts down that are really progressive issues. And so progressives are extremely challenged by this as well. And it's not just, hey, if you have an unpopular right-wing opinion, the left is going to come after you. It's a corporate problem. And the only reason that I think that certain corporations lean left is because their consumer base wants them to. They're just responding to their consumers in a lot of ways. As much as there's power dynamics that control consumers as well, I understand that it's a back and forth, but these things go hand in hand. So I do realize it's problematic, but when I'm critiquing corporate power, I don't throw other issues under the bus for it. I try to like keep them as entangled as they are. I try to keep it in focus that way.
Yeah, I think that the whole issue of electronic surveillance, particularly with emerging artificial intelligence, sifting through seas of data that we generate through our movements and our behaviors and our social connections. I think this is rapidly transcending problems associated with corporate power. You know, the book that I just finished was called The Big Nine by Amy Webb. And it is about the big nine companies that are developing artificial intelligence. And those companies are, in the United States, the G Mafia, you know, that's Google, Amazon, Microsoft, Facebook, Apple. What's the I? Maybe the I is silent. I don't know. But the other the other three companies are Baidu, Tencent, and Alibaba, Chinese companies whose activities are directed and coordinated by the Chinese Communist Party. You know, they're not that clearly. The Chinese Communist Party is not anti-capitalist like they used to be. They're you know, very gung-ho capitalist, but unapologetically totalitarian, you know, unapologetically anti-democratic. And the techniques that they're using were largely developed in Silicon Valley, but they have been adapted for use by the Chinese government. And now, because the Chinese government is playing this coordinating role in a way that the US government is not, the US government has sort of thrown its hands up and said, Silicon Valley, do whatever you want, make a lot of money. You know, the intelligence community supports the Silicon Valley companies clandestinely as much as they can because they know that Google can do things the CIA could never do. But once Google does those things, they can certainly hand the information off to the CIA. But I think China is taking the lead, and their primary aim in the use of this technology is social control, maintaining their power, making sure that people are unable to gather and communicate in ways that would foster revolution, be it violent or nonviolent. And that's going to feed back into what's happening here. The techniques that they're developing in China will be applied here as long as it makes somebody money. Apparently, the US government is not going to interfere. So I think that cybernetic, electronic, you know, AI-driven surveillance and social control is rapidly outgrowing the problem of, you know, corporations having too much power.
Yeah, but the corporations are the ones with that power. So
right now in the US, but again, China is rapidly overtaking the United States in the use and the deployment of this technology.
They're you can say it's the Chinese government, but I mean, it's like, it's always a cooperation between, it's a syndicalist cooperation. It's corporations and governments. It's not just the Chinese government. We have to define what that is. It's institutions.
Well, yeah, I haven't made much mention of the Chinese government. I think I've mostly been saying the Chinese Communist Party.
Okay. Yeah, that's still kind of vague.
Well, it tells you what echelon we're talking about. I mean, like when the Roman Empire fell, you know, the Western Empire, people were still walking on Roman roads. Roman tax collectors were still collecting taxes. Roman administrators were still doing, you know, carrying out the business of government. The only thing that had really changed was who is at the very top of that social pyramid and whether the people in the Eastern Empire recognized him as a legitimate leader. And they decided, no, you know, this most recent guy who claims to be at the top of that pyramid is not a proper Roman. So the Western Roman Empire no longer exists, you know, by it doesn't exist anymore, but clearly it did. It still existed. So when I say the Chinese Communist Party, I'm not talking about, you know, the people doing just the business of administering societal regulation. You know, they're not power brokers. The power brokers are the people at the top, you know, the party officials.
But it's,
I know everybody's a member of the party, but they're not necessarily in the inner circle of the, you know, the people making big decisions and deciding what the priorities will be for the next 5-year plan or whatever.
Okay, and just to refocus here and recenter, what is maybe your point, or what is your question for me?
You made the fair point that saying the government, or in the Chinese government, that's not a unitary entity. There's lots of different agendas at play there. There's lots of different power centers, lots of things going on. That's a very imprecise thing to say, the government or the Chinese government. But when I talk about the actions of the Communist Chinese Party, that is a much more focused locus of power than just saying the government.
So is your, I guess, concern just the paradigm of how China censors right now, and you think this will be adopted by other Western nations? Is that generally the concern, as Western nations
It's not that it will be adopted. It is being adopted.
It has been. Yeah. I mean, like, I feel like in a lot of ways in technology, I've been dealing with that paranoia for a long time, and I felt like we crossed the Rubicon in terms of surveillance a long time ago. And I remember when, like, the Snowden thing was breaking, I was thinking, wait, haven't we been surveilled for a long time now? Like, this has been a story that this isn't the first time this has come up, kind of. It still might be more of a modern story, and this is, I think, and hope how human civilizations evolve, is the invisible becomes more visible and we solve our problems this way. But as far as, like, surveillance, yeah, I think it's definitely an issue. At the same time, I don't know how to get over it, because, like, everything we do is surveilled. It's like, I acknowledge that at this point, kind of, in our lives. Like, we're just in a big data bank somewhere, something, some of your habits or information, whether what porn you look at, you know, everything, these things. And I guess I've just accepted that as a modern person, as troubling that as that is. Like, and I'm keeping my finger on the trend and, like, what's good about it and what's bad about it. But as far as, like, what nation state has the power, this and that, I mean, like, I don't think this is going to dissolve corporate power. Like, I think corporations are running the show, and I don't think it's how technology works right now, as much as, like, the grassroots makes use of it. I mean, we could even talk about things like mesh networks, which is alternative, like, internet sources and other things that, you know, you could say, oh, are being built and utilized, and, these are things that are going to undermine corporations or whoever is in a top levels of Chinese government or whatever. Like, it could be a synthesis of these forces acting to undermine corporations. But I don't see technology as a way to undermine corporations, no. I usually just see it as something that they're going to use to extend their own power, or they'll use intellectual property rights to sort of keep technological progress from people. I mean, like, these are, like, the paranoia I have in my mind about corporations. But generally, I think that I don't see the trend you're seeing there. I do see some of it, like, in terms of just how important it is.
What trend do you think you're seeing?
Well, you said that the technology and how it's being synthesized with China and the surveillance is going to undermine corporate power, but I'm saying that...
No, I don't think it's going to undermine corporate power. I'm not making that argument at all.
Oh, okay. I felt like you said that. I'm sorry if I misunderstood.
I think that focusing explicitly on corporate power is largely missing what's growing up around us, that the methods of social control that ubiquitous computing, mobile computing, and these, you know, pseudo minds, which can tear through enormous swaths of data and correlate things that human minds can't do, that this is spilling out of the bounds of the corporation. The corporation is a power center right now. You know, the laws that govern how corporations work make it so, but you could dissolve, you know, you could strip away those legal protections for corporations, bring them down to size, and that's not going to diminish this new power. It will change form. And my point about China is that, you know, the things that are strictly taking place in the corporate realm here in the United States are explicitly coordinated by the upper echelons of the Chinese Communist Party in China. They are directing the development of this technology, how it's deployed, how it is used to control people's lives.
Yeah, I mean, like these, for sure, these are two parallel elements of power in our society, technology and corporations, like institutions and actual physical surveillance technology. You know, these things are intermeshed institutions in and of themselves. So I agree, like, yes, you remove one, and if you still have a tyranny of another, like, what does that mean, right? Or what would that look like? And I'm not entirely sure what that would look like without corporate power. I can't answer that question. I appreciate you're trying to project, but I really don't know what that world looks like beyond what I want it to look like, which is a much more distributed flat power dynamic across the globe, you know, and like something sustainable, because I just don't think we're sustainable, however you want to define that. I don't think that civilization is going to end tomorrow, but I'd like to get ourselves on some sort of track where, you know, we're not having a lot of the environmental issues or the overpopulation issues, climate issues. It's just, we got to get that shit under control. So that's sort of where my focus is. As much as like technology is a concern, I like to think of it right now as a help. And like, here I am talking to you and we're dialoguing, and like, I try to be an optimist about it, you know, like it's really useful for this and for people building, if we're talking about power and like distributed power, and like what we're doing now is like a form of distributed power that people have never had before either, you know? And so that makes me feel stronger and able to feel like I can accomplish something by reaching across space and time and putting minds together. It's cool. And that is powerful. And so that's kind of my vision for the future. It's like the technology, I think if it becomes less centralized, and that's what I feel like with the disappearance of corporate power, we'd have a decentralization. I'm not saying that's always good, but at the same time, like, you need some centralization, but I think it would help some of our issues, and it would make things a bit more egalitarian in terms of how technology is used, and we'd have more say in how it's used, and we'd have less concerns about, you know, censorship, et cetera, et cetera.
Huh. Yeah, I don't share that optimism at all, but, you know, I'm...
That's fair. That's fair, but...
has been deplatformed from these things for saying things that other people don't like. You know, I can be censored in a way now that I couldn't have been before there was social media. You know, I can be punished for my speech in a way that I couldn't have been, you know, when I was half my current age.
Well, I mean, like, I think like punishing is kind of the wrong word. I understand what you're saying, but like, I can't view it that way. It's like, if we understand the social climate we live in, and we're going to be contrarian to that social climate, at some point, like, you can't get mad about any microtransgression against you. If, again, I know you don't like being called white and privileged, but I'm telling you, you're white and privileged despite the setbacks you've had in your life. Cause like, I know we both have debt things in our past, and it's like, it's really tough. And it's like,
what in our past?
Debt, we've been encumbered by debt, and we know what that means, and like the stress of that and living with that and the burden and the guilt and the other horrible fucking things that come with it. Life is hard. And so I'm not telling you, you haven't had a hard life, you haven't struggled, or you haven't gotten by on your own merit, but some of it, and a lot of it, we haven't gotten by on our own merit. So that's all I'm saying. It's like, yeah.
You're not going to get an email from Google or Twitter or YouTube or Facebook tomorrow saying that you are no longer allowed to access these platforms because of the things that you've said.
It depends on what I've said. I mean, like, again, exactly. If I'm putting something up again about like...
The whole position that you're articulating here is one that is completely safe for you to articulate via the method of the tools provided by Silicon Valley.
No, because like I told you, like, I would have problems posting things about Black liberation theology, or I would have issues posting things about Palestinian liberation. And if I was posting something anti-Israel, I'd be anti-Semitic. You know what I mean? Like,
have you been denied access to the platforms?
I don't participate enough in these to do it. Like I'm saying, I don't do it because I know there'll be ramifications. I just like, this isn't how I actuate my life. This isn't how I like do things. So I don't participate in the platform so much, but I understand people's frustrations that do, and your frustrations as a person that does. But I'm saying it cuts both ways, and we just can't say, I'm being picked on for using this word, but I'm like, that word has ramifications, man. It's like why we don't use the N-word anymore. It's why we don't call like a person of color colored, you know what I mean? It's just like we've learned that these things have social and historical and now contemporary ramifications for people's psyches, emotions. And it's like, we're not treating each other like snowflakes. What we're learning is that we're all fucking human and sensitive, and that to find solutions and working together, deconstructing the walls inside of us that have been built over time, sometimes for various reasons that aren't fair to the other people we're interacting with. I think we just have to be aware and like try to be growing and not, and be concerned with power, but understand that it's cutting both ways and that you're not being unequally disenfranchised in this climate. It's tough for everyone and we're all sorting it out. And the corporate power element, I feel like, is a separate discussion and doesn't have anything to do with the identity politics. I feel like that's been a conflation.
Well, I'm interested in technology. I'm interested in democracy. I'm interested in how societies create themselves with explicit rules and structures, but also with emergent behaviors. And if you want to isolate identity politics, it's not a particularly interesting discussion to me. What's interesting to me is how somebody who takes a particular stance on identity politics is in no fear of being denied the ability to buy an airplane ticket or travel unencumbered or make a phone call. Whereas increasingly in the world that we are building for ourselves, if you express an opinion which is not allowed, you know, here in the US, it's fairly innocuous so far. You can't upload to YouTube. You can't use Facebook. You can't use Twitter. But in China, if you have a low social credit score, you can't buy a plane ticket. Mm-hmm. You can't take a bus far from your house. Really, really locked down. And what I see, you know, happening in China, I'm sure will be employed here against us sooner rather than later, largely to the applause of the people whose views are being favored, which right now, you know, given who works at these companies in Silicon Valley, and given, as you say, their perception of the desires of their customers, they're favoring one set of ideas and clearly, unambiguously, punishing people who are resistant to those ideas or who articulate a counter set of narratives.
Okay, so do you think like Pepe the Frog should be allowed to be posted on all these platforms and everyone's just like laughing about it and it's a big fucking joke? Or do you think that's actually like a toxic image that we could do without? And honestly, I don't care if an evil corporation is taking it down or not. Like, I think it's fucking toxic. And I think all the conversations around it are pointless to the point of sucking. They're like energy vampires. Some of these posts and these other things, they suck our energy and they make us commit to pointless emotional labor. Is being racist okay? You know, all these stupid questions. Like, no, it's not okay. Posting this isn't okay. It's like, and why? And it's a lot of work to educate people. For like, I went to school for education, and a lot of that is cultural competency and multicultural understanding and understanding about like where we're at in our society and like the healing and work that needs to be done. And if a large part of the consumer base is on that train and we're working towards that sort of zeitgeist that I feel is a lot more positive than the zeitgeist we've had in the past, even if there's still stuff to be worked out, I'm okay with the general trajectory, though I do still think that there's problems like you're saying, where we need to be able to distinguish between people that are really being toxic and people that aren't. And I do think that corporate oversight isn't the best way to do this, because they're just going to do stuff in blanket ways and be obnoxious about it and piss us all off and kind of turn us against each other, I think, because their decision-making is bad in terms of how they police these things. But I do think that certain forums and certain platforms, I'm okay with Pepe the Frog not being on there. I'm okay with Pizzagate stuff getting taken off. These are not relevant political conversations to me, except that they express people's vitriol and paranoia and complete conspiracy about how the way the world works. And I'm done talking conspiracy theory with people. I want to talk about the real fucking problems that are affecting people's lives. And I think that everything we've talked about here, regardless of what we want to talk about in terms of emphasis and importance, everything we've talked about here affects people's lives, and all these topics are important. And whoever's listening, like, it's worth learning about everything and becoming as holistic a human being as you can be in terms of engaging with the world and seeing how other communities do what they do and learning from that and hoping we can get our shit together, you know?
not sure I heard you correctly. Are you saying that you think it is okay to ban images of Pepe the Frog because you think that it's an unproductive conversation to have?
It's unproductive. I mean, I really do think images can harm.
But the important thing is it okay to ban this image? Is it okay to punish people who find value in it and want to share it with other people?
I mean, again, if we're talking about living in the imperfect society we live in, where it is a private platform. I don't know what to say about it. They have grotesque relationships with governments, but they are private companies and they are doing what they're allowed to do. And they're allowed to basically take on and off what they want. We're not talking about like some sort of agreed upon forum where it's like a free for all. Like, these are just like things with rules, and I don't know what to say about it. Like, I'm okay with people policing their own platforms. Yes. Like, for example, like, I'll occasionally tune into Twitch and Twitch streams video games. And I like that. I have that inside me. I'm a kid from the video game culture. I still like that kind of stupid nonsense. And you go into these chats and some of them are complete free-for-alls and I feel like disgusting places, and you can choose to avoid it, of course. But then there's other ones where people really go out of their way to like create a good culture in their chat. And that's like not just everyone kumbaya, blah, 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 but it's like someone's not going to drop in with like racist memes and other stuff. And like those people get banned and aren't welcome back, because it's like, if we're talking about coming together as whatever, as a society, like these things are just, I feel like they're atomic bombs for getting through anything. And so that's what I'm saying. Like, I'm okay with it being banned for that reason, for the first reason that the platforms, and they can do what they want, unfortunately, for now. And once we get more free platforming, we can figure it out. And second, yeah, I do think they're really fucking unproductive. And I do think images harm. And I think that's a huge unexplored topic in mainstream discussion about, you know, media imperialism and how it affects our brains and how we developed our thinking processes, you know? So no, yeah, I guess, does that answer your question?
No. Okay. You've really mushed two things together that need to be separated.
Okay.
It's a very different thing to say, you know, I have, say, a conversational discussion forum on MeWe.com. I'm the administrator. I decide, you know, what the topic is and what the conversational boundaries are. That's one thing. But if MeWe as a corporation says, here are a list of things you're allowed to talk about, and here are a list of things that you will be banned from the platform for talking about, regardless of, you know, your intention in creating your little sub-community, those are very different things. Are you saying it's okay to, like, because Pepe the Frog is just a green cartoon frog? I mean, what's offensive are the attitudes of the people who use it as an emblem. So are you saying it's okay for a company like Twitter, say, to tell all the people who find community and value and, you know, and associate it with this image that they're not welcome to use this platform, at least in that way?
Again, like, I don't see that distinction that you do. I still think they're both private platforms. So you're talking about a sub community within a larger community, that they're both private communities. So I'm still struggling to see like how we should differentiate those things, because one's bigger than the other. Yeah, but they, as far as how we concern public and private, they still have that right to say, this is like not part of our culture, and if you want to be part of another culture, go participate in somewhere else, or try to create it, or do what you got to do. A lot of alt-right people have done that, and it's still,
you say that, but then people go and they create BitChute, they go and they create Minds.com, they go and they create Gab, and those same Silicon Valley companies and their cheerleaders with that libertarian line of, hey, these are private companies, they don't have to abide by, you know, the same standards of fair play that a public institution would.
Well,
then they also cheer when the banks and the credit card companies and the telecommunication companies all turn around and then try to attack and shut down these newly created alternative, you know, free speech platforms.
Okay, so as someone who, again, doesn't see value in a community around Pepe the Frog, like, if we want to say they have the freedom to do it, whatever, like,
but it has, I don't have
value.
To
see, I don't understand. Like, is that like not understood? Like, it has zero value. So we're saying this thing is zero value, but we still think that everyone should be able to like worship it, or like we should encourage it because it's like, it's free, but it's like, it's stupid and it's toxic to our society. So why can't we all agree in a general sense, because we are in a problematic democracy where it's like 51% can win the election and 49% are shit out of luck. Mm-hmm. Okay. But it's sort of worked so far. So I'm not like super uncomfortable with the way that's working right now, even though it's messy. And I feel like that's what's happening right now. It's just like, there's that push and pull and we're working with it. And there's things I want to see in the internet and things I don't. I'm not the arbiter of that, but I do think that any society that comes together has to talk about rules and decorum and whether right now it's...
Okay, but you're not addressing what I just talked about.
Oh, go ahead.
So we've got the mainstream platforms where these conversations play out. And, you know, we're talking Twitter, we're talking Facebook, YouTube, and the corporate culture of Silicon Valley, which is very leftist, has basically said there are certain types of conversations that we will not allow to take place on our platforms. And so the people that want to have those conversations say, okay, fine, we're going to go create our own new platforms. And then the old mainstream platforms attempt to undermine, sabotage, and basically disintegrate the new platforms using all manner of underhanded means. How is that defensible?
It's not defensible in terms of like the power asymmetry there, but it is defensible in terms of like actually being able to bring economic pressure onto a small platform from a big platform, for example, and shutting it down. That's quote unquote unfair.
I'm not concerned so much about fair. I'm concerned about how is it even defensible? How can you even say that it's okay to, one, kick everybody with a particular opinion off of the mainstream platforms, but then pursue them to the newly created platforms that they've created so they can carry on their conversations and have, you know, their priorities, because you judge their conversations to be of zero value. But there's a huge jump between, I think your conversation has no value, too. I am going to beat you up and, you know, sew your mouth shut so you can't talk about certain things.
Yeah. But we're not physically doing this to people. We're not going to their homes and actually telling them, don't do this. We're not actually shutting them up. And I'm not AT&T. I'm not these credit card companies. Okay. And like, I can't control them and we can't always control them. But the fact is, like, if they for once, like, if government gave us healthcare tomorrow, universal healthcare, I wouldn't say I'm really upset that this asymmetrically powerful thing is doing something good for once. And if like AT&T and the credit card companies, who I don't fucking like usually, if I do think they're using their power for something that we could talk about in terms of censorship, but I'm talking about it just in terms of helping to create a culture that is productive and gets us talking about things that aren't just dragging people into the mud of, hey, you look like a frog, let's talk about this, like the dirty immigrants and this sort of stuff. Like, this is what a lot of alt-right people want to have discussions about, just really derogatory. They're non-starters. So that's why I'm saying like the platforms have zero value. And second, I don't, and as far as defense goes, as defensible stuff goes, like, and I don't like these large institutions bludgeoning small guys over the head. Like, even Alex Jones, I saw as a small guy and he got a bit bludgeoned. But at the same time, Alex Jones is a piece of shit. I'm okay saying that. I'm not on my moral high horse. He's just like, he's a toxic individual. And so I don't mind that he's deplatformed or something. You know, it's like another one bites the
dust. Yeah, I see that as a very, very dangerous attitude, one that will do enormous harm. That
when
if I judge somebody's their
when and how like when the trans agenda takes over and they're all running the show and they put all the white guys in camps, like, what is everyone afraid of? Like, I don't understand that response.
See, people are not very good at predicting the specifics of the future, and I'm not going to try, but I recognize a bad precedent when I see one. You know, it's not incumbent.
Complete free speech is not a precedent either. That's never been the way, and I don't like presenting our history or what we've done up to this point is complete free speech. And God bless America, you know, salute, because of our free speech, we've gotten to where we're not. That's not the truth. Okay.
Open. There doesn't have to be a golden age in the past for me to say that, you know, freedom of expression is a value that I hold dear, and that I'm upset when I see it abridged. And I see it being abridged in a way that is pretty new right now, and the methods for defending against it haven't really been worked out, and it's pushing very hard in a disturbing direction. And it's really weird to me to hear, you know, people who have a sort of social leftist viewpoint coming out with these libertarian talking points saying, hey, it's a private corporation, they can do what they want. Whereas if that private conversation was doing something that offended you, you wouldn't take that line. You know, if the private corporation was being openly discriminatory and discriminating against women and people of color, and somebody said, hey, it's a private corporation, they can do what they want, you wouldn't buy that. You wouldn't accept that.
Right.
You would say, no, there has to be some accountability. There has to be some method for people, you know, who have been marginalized to have a voice. It's just when the people whose conversations and whose attitudes you don't like are being discriminated against that you're like, hey, it's a private corporation. They can do what they want.
No, I just think it's, I do think there is something to, like, again, it's not a completely, this is a difficult conversation, but as far as like evolving as a society and realizing when things are worth fighting over and not, and when, like, I don't know if maybe we should get into a particular case study. Maybe you have a particular case in mind instead of we're just talking about all these poor people getting banned who have all these important things to say and then them going to their platforms that are also very important and then them being shut down. And like, I don't know what to say about that at this point. Like, I feel like we've reached the end of what we can say in a lot of ways, though I do think that, again, you're not giving enough emphasis to how up to this point media has operated. Up to this point, you could basically do whatever you wanted on these platforms and for a long time, and basically forcing already marginalized people further from the margins, because technology is a thing that we are using more and more to connect with, like you're talking about, like as whatever, as technology is going to stay and people are going to get more access to it. We want that. We want to increase access. But when we make it a completely unwelcome place for largely women, people of color, immigrants, et cetera, Islamic people, et cetera, brown people, whatever, they have mostly been on the margins. And so what we're trying to do as a community, as society, is to bring them together. And unfortunately, these corporations are also part of it, and these platforms are also part of it. Okay. I think we can all be part of the solution, even fucking Amazon, who we want to think of as evil and is kind of in a lot of ways, but it's also just a company and we're trying to work with it and get it under control. I'm not saying that, oh, they're a private corporate. I'm not applying that double standard. But when I think someone's doing something, I think they're doing something right and you're doing something wrong. It's not a bad standard. I'm not saying a bad standard for censorship, because I think that my rules for interaction should be different than yours in a public space. Or in these sort of platforms. I'm not saying that free speech isn't important. I'm not saying that being able to voice an opinion isn't important, but I think a lot of people don't know how toxic their opinions are, and they come in sort of like a bull in a china shop, you know, and they cause a lot of harm to people on the internet especially, and it basically pushes them further out. So all those people who didn't have access before, including the poor, and who are mostly in large concentrations, people of color, etc., this is a strategy to bring them in and to increase the conversation. You know what I'm saying? Like, I just think the conversation has been so slanted in a very white, typical American way, you know, how we've all understood like media in a lot of ways up to now. And now that's changing, and it's difficult because a lot of new voices are in where there weren't before. And so I think that there's been a bit of a crowding out, but I think that's okay. And I think it's for the better. And that's all I can say about it. You know, I don't want to be villainized, and I don't want other people on the left who have these points of view about that are more complex views about censorship to be villainized as authoritarians, because that's not what it is. Like, if anything, it's a embodiment of civic republicanism, which is different than classical liberalism in terms of how we have responsibilities to each other and how society progresses. You know, the classical liberal view of society that you're expressing here isn't the only one. And I'm just trying to express that other one that is so unexplored that I feel like there's just a complete illiteracy about it. And we're talking through each other sometimes, that you're seeing something of what I'm saying that's not there, as much as I'm having, you know, I don't always communicate perfectly well, but at the same time, I realize sometimes I do have double standards. I'm not without double standards, but we have to work with that. I'm just sort of like, this is complicated. But again, I think everything we talked about here is important. Both sides have something relevant to say, at least coming from you. You know, when you're bringing up these issues, I take it more seriously. Okay. When I talk to some other people, I realize that they're actually not centered or grounded or have their eyes on the right thing at all. Like, that's the truth. Like, there's just a lot of issues that are, you talked about Trump in the beginning. It's like, we can talk about the issue on Putin as being a distraction. You know, there's other, I think, distractions, and it's like, fights over should Pepe the Frog be allowed on the platform as a distraction. I'd just rather be like, yeah, we're okay with it being policed in this particular case, you know, because it's like, it's shown to be kind of bad. So I don't know what else to say about it besides that. But I appreciate your wanting to defend our ability to be able to see each other, you know, for who we are, and to be able to like talk around that and build off of that. It's tough.
It is tough.
That was John, his podcast, and the archive for it is still up, and it is a beautiful website, I have to say. But the podcast is called Pentimental, and you can find it at thesyncbook.com. That's thesyncbook.com. I was the guest on episode number 14 of the Pentimental podcast, and I'm looking at the website now, and that was, oh wow, that was June 22nd, 2015. So almost 4 years ago, as I mentioned, it could have been last week for as far as, you know, the time indexing function of my memory goes. Things are moving quickly, I have to say. I know one thing that doesn't always move quickly is the time between episodes. So this is an extra long one. I was tempted to break it up into two episodes, you know, get 2 weeks worth out of it. But now I'll serve it up as a single episode, and I will come up with something else for you quite soon. Thank you very much for supporting my work. Thank you for listening. Thank you for taking an interest. And until you next hear my voice, stay well.